Welcome back to We Are Here, a Keystone Edge podcast starring Pennsylvanians making their mark. I'm your host, Lee Stabert. This series has been created in partnership with PA Humanities, an organization dedicated to building community and sparking change. We hope these conversations will do the same. The Jefferson Educational Society calls itself a Main Street think tank. What exactly does that mean? Well, this Erie-based organization fosters civil-civic dialogue, hosting programming both at their headquarters downtown and at satellite sites throughout the county. One of those sites is in East Erie, a diverse, close-knit community that has struggled with divestment. The Jefferson Educational Society brought the conversation to East Erie, but not before asking the local community what exactly they needed to be talking about. This work is all in the service of creating a more equitable and vibrant Erie. To talk about the history of the city as an economic and political bellwether, the power of conversation, and why every municipality should have its own local think tank, we welcomed Raven Clark and Ben Spegan of Jefferson Educational Society.
My name is Raven Clark. I'm the Satellite Program Coordinator at the Jefferson.
I am Ben Spegan. I'm the Vice President of the JES.
So let's start by just explaining what exactly the Jefferson Educational Society does and where the idea came from and how it started.
So the Jefferson Educational Society is a Main Street think tank. And I'll get to the Main Street in a bit in the conversation, unpacking what it is we are and when we identify as a think tank. But really, we act as a platform for civil-civic dialogue, a catalyst for community progress. And that's essentially being an incubator of ideas, a place where people can gather to both learn and grow and share and exchange. We traffic in information, and that's really important. And we do that locally within our own community at various different sites, including where we're headquartered, but our satellite sites. We do that virtually through digital programming. Why it exists, we were fortunate enough to have some really, really bright folks, scholars, academics, researchers, civic leaders, get together and ask a simple question. Why is it taking so long for ideas to get to a place like Erie, Pennsylvania? And they came to find that it was because of the absence, a vacuum that was existing, that there wasn't a place for the exchange of ideas. Now, in larger metros, you see often R1 universities that are focused on research, playing that role in adult lifelong learning or civic education, where they're addressing education of the third age, as they say in the UK, where adults are coming back to learn for learning's sake. That was something that wasn't being addressed in a place like Erie. So we first opened our doors on May 29th, 2008, and from there have really grown. Now, that day is important because the other thing we might think of in that time and in that era was that was when the Dow Industrial Jones dropped 777 points that very day that a think tank in Erie, Pennsylvania opened its doors. The exciting thing about that, I think, is that the founders weren't deterred, that more than ever, people needed a place to gather, to talk about crises, but also embrace opportunity and exchange ideas, learn from one another, and see how they can improve their community. Because I think that's really the through line is if we're not getting better and we're not growing, then what are we doing as a community? And if we're not creating a space for that to happen, the exchange of ideas in a nonpartisan way for us, you know, not taking a side, but really presenting ideas and informing the community so then action can be taken, we're not growing. And we've provided that fertile ground for that to happen. And it's exciting to look back on it now 15 years later of how it's grown, how it's evolved, and how it's really been a space that continues to feed the community and be fed by the community.
So I think that before we go further, I just want to talk about Erie because we live in a big state. I'm in Philadelphia right now. It would probably take me about as long to get to Erie as it would to go to Europe, at least if I'm driving versus flying. You know, it can feel pretty remote, but we're all in the same state. There's a lot that connects us, but I think for a lot of people, they don't know so much about Erie. Raven, can you maybe speak about what the community is like, what the built environment is like, well, a little bit about the geography and why this is both a special place, but maybe a place that is a little bit remote. And you're talking about that lack of accessibility to ideas or things taking a little longer to get there.
So Erie is my home. I was born and raised here. And people who are from here or who come here have a lot to say about Erie. Good and bad. Some of it might be true, but to me, Erie is a wonderful place for people to just come together and enjoy life. We're right on Lake Erie. The Great Lakes are the largest set of freshwater bodies of water that we have in the world. So the lake is definitely an asset to the Erie community. We have a lot of outdoors resources for people to enjoy. Erie is also a very culturally vibrant area. We have a lot of different cultures coming together. We have a lot of new Americans in Erie. Every summer, we have a whole bunch of cultural festivals that go on. We have music festivals, just a lot of cool, fun things that are going on in Erie that are positive for the community.
Ben, anything to add? And anything maybe about some of the challenges that Erie faces as it's trying to, you know, create a more equitable, environmentally rich community?
So like many legacy cities, Erie has, and in some ways continues to struggle with what is its 21st century identity. So Erie clearly emerges as a manufacturing center, and that's thanks to its role in the War of 1812, building the fleet for the Battle of Lake Erie. And ever since then, we've been really good at making things. And we've seen that evolve throughout the decades. And we really saw that begin to hit a peak at the turn of the 20th century when General Electric Transportation builds a headquarters not far outside of the city in Lawrence Park, and continued to be the number one employer in the region for a very long time. And we saw a city on the rise, growing. Its population peaked at 140,000. That happened in the 60s. And since then, you know, we have struggled with challenges that many other small to medium to even large metros experience. Urban flight, white flight, people leaving the city, creating a donut, so to speak, of neglected or blighted properties. And that's been a real challenge looking at who we are, especially as major manufacturers continue to pull out of the region. It wasn't just GE. And it was others that relocated their headquarters to other cities, took entire workforces with them. It was the loss of blue-collar jobs, but also white-collar jobs. By relocating a headquarters, you take out major philanthropical donors to a region. You lose that capital. So it's been challenging in reimagining ourselves and wondering what Erie might be now. The positive is that we've seen collaboration like never before. And, you know, I humbly say I'd like to think that the JES has played a role in that, of bringing stakeholders together. We have programming designed to do that with the Metro 100 series, to get the 100 most influential people on a given topic who can move the needle around something, gather them together, have them talk about a topic, work on it, come up with solutions, and then go implement that. We've seen that manifest in everything from the advancement of fiber technology to innovation districts, to, you know, addressing other critical issues. We've also seen a shift in workforce. One, our largest employer now is our only homegrown Fortune 500 company, Erie Insurance, which has remained dedicated to staying in the region and employing people. They've expanded their campus, not shrunk it. We see the transition of economy. So I'm hesitant to say post-industrial, that we live in a post-industrial city, because we've not gotten beyond industry. We still make things. And in fact, Wabtec, based in Pittsburgh, has now taken over the headquarters that was formerly General Electric Transportation. And now they're working on not gas-powered trains, but the trains of the future, and building more. So we're seeing a transitional economy when it comes to environment, how we're fueling trains, how we're powering them. We're still seeing people being employed there. We're also seeing the rise of meds and eds, much like other cities have seen. We have a strong network of smaller universities, some private, one connected to the Penn State network, Penn State Barron, but we see two private institutions, Gannon University, Mercyhurst University. We also see just down the road, Edinburgh University, part of the PASHI system. And we also see a community college. We, for the longest time, were one of, if not the largest metro area unserved by a community college. And we just got that a couple of years ago. But already we're seeing advancements. We're seeing the power that education can have, and especially the power that education can have when they collaborate. All of the universities and our county public library are involved in a thing called the Northwest Pennsylvania Innovation Beehive Network. And that essentially acts as a quasi-R1 university to be able to do that kind of research, prop up that kind of entrepreneurship, so that if jobs don't exist, Erie is a welcoming enough place that you can make your job, you can create your job. So we're seeing those challenges. We're seeing people want to talk about that and explore that, learn best practices, and they can do that in a place like the Jefferson Educational Society.
Yeah, it's interesting to hear you talk. These are big macro issues, and I think issues that oftentimes a lot of people picture being hashed out in private rooms, in sort of the halls of power, in administration, in government. And I think part of the mission that you guys are doing is, no, we need to be having those conversations in the community. They need to start at grassroots, at a ground level, because that's the way that they can be effective.
Yeah, I would definitely agree with that. And part of our mission is to make education more accessible to everybody, and especially community initiatives. So we've had multiple programs where we've had community leaders come to the Jefferson and present on community initiatives that they're working on right now. So we had the investment playbook, which was a big project that brought together a whole bunch of community players to work on investment projects in Erie. We've also had the Erie Racial Justice Policy Initiative. The JES has been a convening space for community progress, like we talk about all the time.
Yeah.
It is that role of connector, that role of multiplier, to be able to bring people together and talk about ideas in the light of day. You know, sunlight's the greatest disinfectant for anything, right? You know, let's be transparent about it. And I'd be so blunt to say, like, so many of the decisions, and Erie's not alone, so many of the decisions that were being made in years past, decades past, smoking scotch back rooms by a bunch of white guys who had power, or the dads had power, or the grandfathers had power. How do you break up that power block? And part of what we do as disruptors is, you know, we try to challenge the status quo. The status quo is the status quo for a reason. There are people that are benefiting by it. So that can often be exclusive. We want to be inclusive. And so Raven mentioned the Erie Racial Justice Policy Initiative. We were able to work with the city administration because the city had sat down and said, we want to talk about race issues in Erie. Now, there was a study that came out that heralded Erie as the worst place to live for African Americans. That study was in 2017. There were people who were quick to challenge the methodology of that and say, well, they used some fudge numbers, incorrect data. You know, these were county stats, not city stats. And, you know, I don't know. But if you're arguing over whether or not you're number one or you're number three or you're number seven, yeah, you still got a problem and you're having the wrong conversation, right? So the city actually took that on and worked with another nonprofit called the People's Supper to gather people around a table and just talk. You know, talk about race issues, what it means to be white, what it means to be black, what it means to be new American, what it means to be Latino, what it means to be on and on and on. After that, there are several different initiatives that emerged, and one of them was the idea that the Better Together Council would be the steward of these various initiatives. The pandemic happened, right? And that was wholly disruptive to a lot of programmatically based initiatives. We couldn't gather people together under the Better Together Council. At the same time, the council looked inward and said, actually, policy reform is a way to change, make systemic change, you know, not just, address something, you know, at the surface level, but how do you get into the root of something? Well, change policy. And so they called upon the city and said, look, we want to do this. We want to do a project that's going to look at racial justice in our community. And the city gave, blessing to that and said, this is a great idea. Let's go do this. And knowing that there weren't policy experts on the Better Together Council, they approached the JES and said, you're a think tank. This is what think tanks do. This is think tank work. Can you, one, help us identify a national consultant, two, be a facilitator of the phase one of the project, and actually get us forward toward action? And we did that. We were able, through our network that's developed through all of the myriad of style of programming we do, we were able to say we know people and made a connection to an absolutely brilliant scholar, Dr. Camille Bousset, a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, now the interim vice president of governance studies there. And she was able to come in and consult on this and work and get to know the community over a 12-month-long period that actually extended a little bit longer because the work wasn't finished and she was committed to it. And so we were able to help the group come up with initiatives, action that they're taking now. Raven has seen the group continue to meet in phase two and work on implementing some of those outcomes when it comes to looking at community benefit agreements and other things. So, you know, it's exciting to see how we can play that role of connecting people and then a multiplier effect of, you know, tapping into the network of scholars that we respect who also respect us.
You're listening to We Are Here from Keystone Edge, produced in partnership with PA Humanities, which believes in putting people first. Their work champions the humanities across Pennsylvania, centering growth, equity, and community as a pathway to positive, lasting change. Learn more at pahumanities.org.
So let's talk about East Erie. When did the JES realize this is a community we should be in, and how did the planning process go in terms of creating this satellite programming?
So our East Erie programming is new. We just started that around this time last year. And one initiative that the JES was working on was trying to diversify our constituency base. our typical constituents are, you know, older, usually retired, and not terribly diverse. Our goal, our ultimate goal, is to make our programming more accessible to people. So we wanted to get the word out to more different types of people. And I think we definitely succeeded with the East Erie programming. The Lower East Side of Erie, where we have our programming, is very culturally diverse part of Erie, but it's also pretty economically depressed. It's been an area of Erie that has seen a lot of disinvestment, but things are looking up. There is an initiative called the East Side Renaissance, where they are trying to get more investment in that area. But like I said, it's also very culturally diverse. We see a lot of different races and ethnicities. There are a lot of new Americans who are there. So it was the perfect area to expand our programming to. And we were able to partner with the Erie Center for Arts and Technology. We call it ECAT for short. Just a little background on that. So there are different centers for arts and technology. It started in Pittsburgh with the Manchester Bidwell Method, but they are an organization similar to ours. Their goal is to make education accessible to everybody. They have free art classes for students, so for kids like middle schoolers and high schoolers. They have some career preparation course programs that they do for adults. It's a beautiful center. The building itself has multiple tenants. It's kind of like a central hub for the Lower East Side of Erie for people can go and they can get all sorts of resources. They have a free clinic. They have sports camps for kids. They have birth doulas in training and things like that. We saw this as a perfect opportunity to not only expand our reach, but also just, you know, plant ourselves in the community and be part of that community and to have more opportunity in that community as well.
So can you talk about how the PA Sharp grant helped you do that? And then also, I'm just curious about the bigger picture of, you know, once you're there, how do you get people in the door? How do you spread the word? How do you make sure you're not just sort of attracting the same people over and over again?
Yeah, so our PA Sharp grant we received for the year of 2022, it's what actually allowed us to open up this new satellite location. I was able to become the satellite program coordinator. So it opened up a new job position here. When we first started the programming last year around this time, people were really excited about it. People would come to programs, you know, just like everyday residents would come from the area. And also we saw a lot of community leaders who would come to our programs.
Can you give an example just of a program or two that you offered, just to give people an example of what was gathering people together?
Yeah. So some of our most popular programs were, we had a program about toxic masculinity. We had one about immigration. We've had a couple about incarceration in the justice system. One that we recently had last week was about access to mental health care in the Black, Indigenous, and people of color community in Erie. We've had talks about domestic violence trends in Erie and, you know, other topics. We try to keep our topics relevant to the community that we are holding programming in.
I think an important thing that we have carried into the satellite programming is something that I heard Reverend Jeffrey Brown say. He was the architect of the Boston Miracle that addressed youth-related gang violence in Boston. When he was on our stage, and he was talking about his work. He referenced a quote that is heard often, and it really stuck with me at that event and into this, is that which you do for me without me, you do to me. And I think that's really been the success of the satellite programming, is going out into these communities, all of which are diverse, right? You know, the East Side is diverse in its own way and different than a place like Cory, Pennsylvania, in the southeastern corner of our county that's largely rural. It's diverse in a different way than what's happening at our headquarters. And so dialoguing with the people that are experiencing the program is so important. We're not playing golf where it's one person hitting a ball and just chasing. It's tennis. It's back and forth. It's a dialogue that we can create with a community to say, what is it that you're interested in learning about and how can we help facilitate that? I think that's always just been a hallmark to me of what we've been able to do with the satellite programming, is this idea of go to the people. Take the programming to the people. Don't try to bring the people to us. You know, we have a beautiful building. We're fortunate to have in a building partnership with the Baruch Shalom congregation, where we share a space with just a wonderful group of folks, but we know not everybody can get there. You know, there's barriers of access because of transportation, finances, any number of reasons. So why not meet people where they are? And that's what we've been doing.
Mm-hmm. And we've been using that phrase, meeting the people where we are, to say that we don't want to just come into communities and bring our own stuff and, you know, say, hey, we know you need this. No, we want to meet the people where we are in these communities. We do bring some of our standard like history and political science, you know, politics programming out there, but we make a point to have what I call hyper-local programming. Corey, for instance, was a challenge at first because it is pretty far away from the city of Erie. Erie County is pretty big. And so they have, that community has different challenges and different needs than, say, the city of Erie. So one thing that we found to be very helpful and very insightful were listening sessions. We host a listening session, just like a simple, you know, at the end of a program that we did in December. And we were able to find out different topics that the people who are regulars to these programs wanted to hear about. I was able to get different speaker ideas. Ever since then, we've had sold out programs. So it's very successful when, yeah, you meet the people where they are, ask them what they want, what they need, what they'd like to hear, what they'd like to learn about, and we go forward from there.
Is some of this trial and error, you know, are there any specific experiences either one of you would speak to, whether it's a program that went maybe poorly or didn't attract the audiences that you wanted, or where there were any missteps in terms of this very ambitious goal of meeting people where they are? And then on the other hand, have there were any specific examples of a program that you really felt like nailed it?
And so Raven earlier mentioned, you know, bread and butter kind of programming, right? And that's intentional in what we do. And, you know, if you look across, you know, the observation of adult lifelong learning, what people are interested in, they're interested in learning about themselves. You know, American history tends to always, you know, head toward the top. And then local history, people are interested in that. And so that builds trust and rapport with a group. So, you know, in a place like, you know, Corey, Pennsylvania, it's rural, it leans conservative, you know, much more than other sites that we have. So taking progressive programming, when I first started doing that, I realized that wasn't the way to have these conversations. And that really drove me to want to listen more to people, to say, what is it that you're interested in? Let's build some trust and let's hear each other. And then become more open to more progressive ideas. And that's not to call Corey a not progressive city. In many ways it is, but it's listening to the people that are showing up, because then, you know, it's word of mouth is still the most effective advertising communication we can have, is that somebody goes and tells their friends, hey, I just learned this thing and you should come up with me next time. And so one of the things that I think we were cautious about and weren't sure was going to fly, and say we are team, as I mentioned earlier, the Metro 100 events, and that's intentional to gather stakeholders, community leaders, you know, influencers around a topic. Well, the other important half of that is that there's always followed by a public program, because we might not yet know who that influencer is or who's important in the community to bring them into that conversation. It's always important to make sure that we're not excluding anything from the public. These aren't, you know, locked doors meetings. The public can come in. We wanted to host one of those in Corey, and we hosted it at a time that they were looking at their comprehensive plan, a community plan, an impact plan, and they were trying to figure out how to rally around something and redefine their own image and identity. And part of that was a Rails to Trails initiative. And I took a gamble and said, we got to bring up this guy from Cass, West Virginia. And he runs a state park there. And the reason that I think this is going to work is that they have made it successful. And it's a town of like people that you can count, you know, less than 100. But there's a lot of tourism that happens there. And it's something that Corey was interested in. And the reason that people go there is that they can hop on these wonderful locomotives, ride around the mountains, stay in these beautiful cabins, experience nature in just ways that are beyond amazing. And it's a small community. So why take a gamble on, you know, we've never heard of Cass, West Virginia, even though I'm a West Virginia native and was trying to preach that of like, you've got to bring in people from places that will connect. And the reason it would connect is the locomotive they use is the Climax locomotive. And that was largely manufactured in Corey, Pennsylvania for so long. They have a museum dedicated to it there. The turnout was huge. People could not wait to get in there, so much so that, you know, I think the superintendent of the park was surprised that many people showed up to hear him, you know, to hear about their success stories. And so we were able to dialogue, get the community excited about that, and have it reimagine itself in ways that have really helped advance, you know, impact Corey's work, a community development organization, an economic development organization that's plotting out a strategic plan for the future of that region. And so it's exciting to see when you take some risks, how it can work.
And going off of what Ben said, it's kind of about making it feel for the audience like it's the programming is their own. So we have a program coming up next month that's about Corey Rails and all the stuff that they do. And it's ahead of an open house that they're having. So we anticipate a good number coming out. Our most popular program that we had, and mind you, the space that we have in Corey isn't terribly big, so we can only have so many people. But the most popular program that we had was last year, last summer. It was about a panel discussion about the history of the Corey Area School District. And this was right like at the end of alumni weekend and graduation. People were packed in there like sardines, but they were excited about the programming. It was something that they knew, something that was familiar, something that was about the Corey area.
So how do you assess the impact of all this? How do you know if it's working?
So I have a couple of indicators. First and foremost would be the numbers, how many seats are left vacant when the program starts. So we have different programs at different satellite locations that have been wildly popular, others not so much. But one thing that I've noticed that I've keep track of is the fact that after programs, people tend to stay to talk to each other and network. I've seen people discussing different ideas, you know, like big idea, big plans that could be good for the city or like any of the regions that we operate our satellites in. People will stay like at least half an hour after the program just to talk about not just the program, but about everything else going on in Erie. So we've seen that as a really positive thing.
It's sticky education, and it's really the bookends of a program. One, you know, people often arrive, you know, a few minutes, if not, you know, much more in advance because they want to see other people that are there. They want to talk with them before the program. You know, they're excited about it. They learn at the program. And just like Raven said, it's that stickiness of they're not rushing out the door to get home. And I think this works particularly well with the satellites because they're not rushing out the door to get home because they're in their hometown. They're in their community.
Can we drill down for a second on that word think tank? Because I think it's something people hear and maybe don't really understand. And maybe you could give me a back of the envelope reading of what you think it means and maybe the ways in which JES is rethinking what it can mean.
To me, a think tank is a place where ideas emerge for community review and vetting and either further review or action. I wholly understand why the words think tank might be off-putting to some, might be, but I really think it is a space, you know, and I really like the phrase, you know, platform for civic dialogue. I think that's what we do really well. We bring people in across the political spectrum to present and, you know, we talk about that. And I think the hallmark of successful dialogues that have happened at the JES is that we can agree to disagree without being disagreeable. And our president says that all the time. He also says, you know, we shine a light, we don't draw heat. And it's the idea to reveal things, but we can have serious conversations in which I might not agree with what somebody says on stage, but now I understand where they're coming from better. So we provide that space for it. It's an overused word, but you know, catalyst. And a lot of times people use that to describe we're a catalyst, we get things going. But in a chemical equation, it remains unchanged. That's the nonpartisan nature of what we do. You know, we're not taking a side as an organization or an institution. We don't endorse, you know, candidates. We don't endorse any ideas. We say, let's explore them and the community decides. So that's that reviewing and vetting and either further reviewing and reworking ideas or putting them into action. How can the community change? And sometimes change is very physical, you know, the creation of an innovation district, rethinking how we approach our Bayfront Parkway, which is dividing our crown jewel asset, the lake and the bayfront from the downtown. It can just be, I knew something more about a topic I was curious about than I did before I entered the room. You know, in some ways, we try to subvert that of what people think about when they think about think tanks. Because I think when you say think tanks, people immediately go to Washington, D.C., right? It's the epicenter of the think tank universe. And, you know, if you're walking down the streets of Washington, D.C., you can trip over a think tank. There are so many of them. That's a good thing, right? There should be a cultural center where thought is being trafficked heavily and people are interacting with each other. But we also know the pejorative negative connotations of, you know, inside the Beltway when people think about that. We're a Main Street think tank. You know, we serve our community first and foremost. You know, that's in our motto, community progress. We drive that at the local level. We think that that all ripples out. You know, if the 20th century held true to Chief Justice Brandeis's, the states are the laboratories of democracy, the 21st century is towns and cities. You know, that's where the experimentation can happen in that equation. Let's experiment. Let's see what's working, what's not working. Let's vet ideas. Let's talk with the community. Let's not foist things upon them, but work with them and work resident to resident, shoulder to shoulder, and sometimes screen to screen, and be able to see what wins the day that'll be best for the place, best for the people in the place. How can we make it better?
I think that Erie desperately needed a think tank. We needed a place that was a central convener of people and thoughts and ideas, a place where people could come to learn past just being in school, a place where the community could come together to talk about some of our biggest problems and how we can solve them.
I think an interesting thing about Erie is Erie often is mentioned as like a stand-in for a certain type of American place. You know, mm-hmm. we talk about post-industrial, we talk about a place that has actually been a swing city in terms of politically, gone back and forth. And I think really ravaged by and subject to some of these like huge changes that have happened in America in the last 100-150 years. And I think Erie often, there are a few cities that I think become this sort of like an idea of a place more than a place. It's very interesting to hear you both talk with such passion and specificity about it. So for my last question, what's the future of Erie? What comes next? And what is the role that JES, what is the role that humanities, what is the role that civil discourse has in creating that new Erie, that brighter future?
One thing that is super cool that the Jefferson does as part of our programming, we have a civic leadership academy. It's for young adults, young professionals who are about 25 to 45 years old. I just went through it last year. It's a program where you come together with other young professionals who are passionate about the Erie community. We got the chance to travel to Harrisburg and meet elected officials. We got to meet lobbyists. We meet up with local elected officials, local community leaders, and then we do a group research project where we write a report together. My group's topic was the urban-rural divide in Erie. So I see that as being the future. It's kind of rare to find organizations that work to prop up future leaders. We now have about 200 alumni from the Civic Leadership Academy, many of which have gone on to take on big community leadership roles. Some have become elected officials and are working in government now. So I think that programs like that are what's helping us push ourselves into the future.
I think to imagine what the future is going to look like for Erie, Pennsylvania, you have to look back. And so the Jefferson Educational Society turns 15 this year. 15 years ago, Erie did not have a think tank. It did not have an independent alternative alt-weekly paper, which it now does. It didn't have a co-working space. It didn't have innovation districts. It didn't have an impact investor in the Erie County Gaming Revenue Authority. It has all of those things now, and it's gained so much more. So I think that there's momentum. We've gotten some national attention and continue to get it, but the idea that other towns could benefit from what we're doing, we're a model to be replicated, we believe, or adopted and tailor-made to your own town. You know, it's not to say how we do it's going to work best, but if we can do it in Erie, Pennsylvania, you know, a place where it had a history of ideas would be vetted in terms of market share, you know, like that if a product was being tested, you know, go test it in Erie, Pennsylvania. And if it can succeed there, it would succeed nationally.
See, so you're validating my point that Erie is a symbol. It's America. Erie is America.
Right. It totally is in so many ways. And so if it can work here of all places, like it can work anywhere. And so I think that we have something special. We can't keep it a secret. So if your town is having trouble, you know, advancing civically or having trouble finding ways to talk about it, finding ways to bring in leading edge experts, like we have a formula, it works, you know, and it's not ours to keep. You know, we're not trying to hide what we're doing. We're trying to get the word out.
That's it for this installment of We Are Here. If you have thoughts on the conversation you just heard or ideas for what we should cover in upcoming episodes, please visit our website, KeystoneEdge.com, or visit us via our social channels at Keystone Edge on Instagram and Facebook. Until next time.
Funding for We Are Here comes from PA Humanities and its federal partner, the National Endowment for the Humanities, as part of the American Rescue Plan Act of 2021.